This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. At 6, it's Labor Radio, followed by Prison Pipeline. And be sure to keep listening later this evening for Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective at 7. That's all right here on KBOO, your community radio station in Portland.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Oregon Council 75, representing over 25,000 Oregon public and private sector employees, families, and communities, protecting worker rights and fighting to improve the wages and working conditions of members since 1942. More information at www.OregonAFSCME.com. This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from SEIU Local 503 OPEU, whose mission is to improve the quality of life through worker empowerment and a progressive labor movement, and whose members deliver quality public services to Oregonians every day.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, this is Jamie Partridge, your host for Labor Radio this evening. We're talking about the great postal strike of 1970, the granddaddy of all postal fightbacks, a wildcat strike by impoverished letter carriers and clerk who risked not only losing their jobs but felony charges for striking against the federal government. Calls to return to work by union leaders and court injunctions had no impact on the strikers, and President Nixon calling out 25,000 troops to move the mail failed miserably. Of course, the strike happened in the midst of massive social upheavals, the anti-war movement, the Black Power movement, and a strike wave by a radicalized labor movement. The strike won huge gains, which propelled postal workers' standard of living and union rights well beyond those of other postal workers. This coming Sunday, in the anniversary of the Great Postal Strike of 1970, that is March 17th at 2 p.m., the letter carriers and American Postal Workers unions are, along with the Communities and Postal Workers United, are sponsoring a rally and march starting in Pioneer Courthouse Square, 2 p.m., to save America's Postal Service, to fight to save six-day delivery and door-to-door delivery, and to fight the closures and cuts and delay of the mail. Today, we're in the midst of a growing wave of resistance provoked by wage and service cuts, jobs and housing losses. But beginning in the Middle East and then erupting in Wisconsin and Occupy Wall Street, furthered by the Chicago teachers' victory, Walmart, and fast food strikes, the question today is whether the conditions exist or will soon exist to provoke such a militant fight back as the 1970 strike among today's postal workers and their community allies. Coming up is a talk given a year ago at Socialism 2011 by Tara Lee, a retired postal worker who was a leader in the 1970 strike, and Kianga Yamada Taylor.
Well, I've been introduced as a postal worker, radical, leader of a wildcat strike, and I did that before my 22nd birthday. God, what the hell have I done in the 41 years since? To get back to the postal workers' strike, I'm going to give you a little bit of history of what happened with the postal workers that led up to the strike. I think that I could say like the postal workers first started getting hit with wage decreases back in the Depression in the 1930s, because one of the things that we had back then was the beginning of Keynesian economics and pump priming and everything, except when it came to government workers who took a 25% pay cut under Franklin Roosevelt by executive order, because at that time we had no union and things were done by executive order or acts of Congress pertaining to postal workers and every other government worker. So right away we're 25% behind the rest of the population. And throughout the remaining 30-plus years until we did actually have our strike, we continued to fall behind, because the only way back then that a postal worker got a raise was through an act of Congress. We had no union. We had no collective bargaining agreements, none of that. A postal worker could be fired if the postmaster didn't like the way they looked. That was it. There was nothing we could do. There was no contract, no negotiating, no bargaining rights, nothing. So it comes 1970, and we're falling way behind in wages. Eisenhower had vetoed two pay raises for us during his presidency. Kennedy had passed one, and we're way behind. And to show you some of the ways that this happened to us was because of all the vetoes that presidents made, and then they'd say, well, we want to give the postal workers a 4% raise, and by the time it got through Congress, it might be a 2.5% raise. I got a big raise of 9 cents the first year I worked there. I went from $2.95 an hour to $3.04 an hour. It took 21 years to reach top pay, which was $8,800 a year. Okay? And if you consider that in the big cities and metropolitan areas, people living on $8,800 a year trying to raise a family of four or five, you just could not do that. And there was no way that Congress was going to pass a pay raise for us at the time, because at that time we had Vietnam going on, we had the field war on poverty, we had massive budget deficits, kind of a situation like today almost. Not as bad economically, but somewhat, where we were trying to have an austerity budget come back in, cut federal spending, do away with the waste from the war on poverty, get rid of all those programs that were helping people because we were wasting too much money in Vietnam. I guess over the last 40 years, this country hasn't learned anything either. Well, not the country, but the people in charge of it.
You've been listening to Labor Radio, KBOO Portland, with Tara Lee, a retired postal worker, leader of the 1970 strike, and coming up, Kianga Yamada Taylor.
What I'm going to try to do in my time, 20 minutes, is to give some of the larger context within which this incredibly important and dramatic strike unfolded. One of the things I think is really important with this strike and with this sort of number of strikes, particularly dealing with public sector workers during this period, one of the things that I think is important to bring up about that are some of the things that Tara pointed to. Because today, when you hear politicians from both parties attack public sector workers, I mean, the disconnect between what they are describing and the reasons why people in the public sector became unionized in the first place are completely lost. Instead, it's this discussion in the media and amongst politicians about, you know, bloated pensions, greedy, you know, state and local and federal workers. who want taxpayers to foot the bill for their, you know, profligate lifestyles. And I think, you know, hearing about what the conditions that people actually worked in really explain why, you know, people risked prison, you know, risked losing their pensions 30 years ago to fight for the right for collective bargaining in the first place. Postal workers, as Tara alluded to, started work with $6,200 and maxed out after 21 years at $8,400 or $8,800. And, you know, there was a study done in the late 1960s that showed in New York City that in order to live a sort of modest lifestyle, you needed to be making at least $11,000 a year, you know, not $6,000. And so, you know, that and the antiquated conditions that people worked in the post offices themselves are very important in understanding why people wanted to get unionized, needed to get unionized to defend their basic rights. The sort of arbitrariness of work that Tara pointed to, I think, is very important to understand in that context. And really, the when you understand that, or when you know that history, then you can understand the bravery that people really exacted. Not only did Nixon call out 19,000 federal troops, not just National Guard troops, but also the Army was called out as well. But the courts put out an injunction against the union leadership, but included $1,000 a day fines against all workers who participated in the strike that would be graduated each day. So $1,000 day one, $2,000 day two, $3,000, so on and so forth. And then a $10,000 graduated fine against the union itself. So $10,000 day one, $20,000 day two, so on and so forth. This was the ferocity with which the American state tried to break this strike. And just the last thing that I think sort of demonstrates the disconnect between Congress and the conditions that existed in the post office, Tara mentioned that postal workers, because they did not have a union, could only get pay increases through an act of Congress. Well, there were 2 years. The Johnson administration produced a report in 1968 that really detailed the horrific conditions that postal workers were working under, and recommended that their pay be increased. And for 2 years, Congress did nothing. And so at the end of that two-year period, they come back with I think it was 4.25% raise, which was not enough to cover the cost of living increases, not enough to keep up with the rate of inflation, which was 7% at that point. I think it was a week later, after they proposed this meager pay increase for postal workers, they voted themselves a 41% pay raise. And that really became the final straw for postal workers at that point, that it was clear Congress was not going to be serious about actually dealing with the fact that postal workers were living on, just like sanitation workers in Memphis, had to supplement their income with welfare, with food stamps, working full-time, you know, federal jobs, that they were going to have to take action, take that into their own hands. And so, you know, I think that some of that history is important in today's discussions about, you know, the public sector and, you know, public sector workers and whether or not they're too greedy in asking for too much. That is, I think, part of that history is important, an important part of the context within which to understand that discussion. But beyond that, I think that, you know, there are several reasons why this strike is incredibly important and deserves to be sort of resurrected, because it's really a labor action that many people do not know about. I think one of the reasons as well is because there is a popular notion that the working class, that labor itself was on the sidelines of the social movements in the 1960s. When we talk about the 1960s, you know, people hear about the civil rights movement, the urban rebellions, the women's movement, the beginning of the gay liberation movement, the rise of student movements, the movement against the Vietnam War, et cetera. But when we hear about labor, often, you know, it's this caricature of construction workers in their hard hats beating up anti-war activists. You know, that's one portrayal. Or it's the so-called silent majority that gave Richard Nixon the presidency in 1968 that entertained the Southern segregationist George Wallace's presidential campaign in that 1968 election. And people who were just generally against civil rights and black equality, et cetera. And I think, in fact, the worker rebellion of that period, you know, not only is that a caricature, but it really misses the way in which the rebellion, the rank and file rebellion of that period was really shaped and fueled by the black protest of the time, from the civil rights movement to the black liberation movement through the end of the decade, and the way in which the migration of African Americans to urban centers and becoming entrenched parts of the workforces across the North fundamentally shaped the direction of those working class of those working class struggles. And I think that there are, you know, aspects of that narrative that have some truth to them in terms of, you know, there was a backlash against the movements of the 60s. But in many ways, the postal worker strike of the 1970s and of 1970, and indeed the general upsurge of working class activity from the mid-1960s through 1974 indicates that the attempts to portray a general picture of the working class as more conservative, reactionary, and racist is simplistic at best and completely erroneous at worst. Moreover, understanding the worker rebellion of the 1960s and 70s also demonstrates that neither can we look at the labor movement. It complicates how we look at the understand the labor movement itself, not as this united entity, but the rank and file rebellion of the late 1960s and 70s also revealed the deep chasm that existed within the labor movement between a sort of entrenched leadership at the top, sort of looking out for their own interests, and the rank and file members. The ordinary workers who made up the heart of that movement. And so I think all of that really contributes to all of that, with understanding the postal workers strike contributes to, I think, why that is something important. One of the, I think, in terms of the labor movement itself, and how do you you know, how does the wildcat strike, this upsurge of wildcat strike activity happen in the first place, means looking at how the labor movement itself transformed from the course of the 1930s, when the industrial unions formed for the first time, to the 1960s. I don't have time to go through all of that. It's the benefit of being at this conference. There, you know, there are talks about the history of the labor movement in the 30s. There are different talks about the labor movement throughout the weekend. But I think that there are three key things to look at. One of the structural changes within the labor movement itself, and how the upsurge of the 1930s gets transformed into really a sort of the development of a labor bureaucracy by the 1960s, and really a disconnect from the conditions faced by ordinary workers during that time. The second thing I think is important to look at are the demographic changes that happen within the labor movement. In terms of the movement of black workers, in particular from the South to the North, who become very important, concentrated in industry across the North, but also become very central to public sector work as well. By the late 1960s into 1970, the federal government is the largest employer of African American workers at that point. And really, the federal government, as industry begins to leave urban spaces, the federal government becomes this sort of employer of last resort. In response to the urban rebellions of that time, there's an urgency to actually employ people, to find jobs for people. And then the last thing, which I think is most important in terms of understanding the context that could produce this kind of confidence and rebellion in the workplace, were the social movements, in particular the civil rights and the Black Power movement of that time, in terms of creating both the sense that people could that people had the right to fight for different conditions, but also in terms of actually providing a model for what a successful struggle could look like. So I wanted to say something about public sector work in particular, because I don't think that it is, I don't think that it's, you know, it's just coincidental that postal workers, who are federal workers, were that this something like this could happen in a federal workplace. It wasn't just an industry, like I said before, that blacks were becoming more concentrated in the public sector. In 1961, John F. Kennedy signed an executive order giving federal workers the right to organize but not to strike. By 1970, half of black male college graduates and more than 60% of college-educated black women were public employees, compared with 35% of white men and 55% of white women. And although 18% of the labor force in 1970 were government employees, 26% of African Americans worked for the government. Between May 1973 and May 1974, 64% of all new federal employees came from minority groups. Black workers were also found in municipal and government work, where the wages were higher, 15% higher than in public sector work for black men, and 20% higher for black women, and the benefits were better. And the influx of African Americans into both public and private workplaces in the midst of the unfolding black freedom movement not only changed the demographics of American labor, but also brought the urgency and militancy of the black freedom struggle into the workplaces themselves. One way in which that happened was that it opened up the space for the civil rights movement in particular, opened up the space for reform in the first place. Black workers, there was a directive for affirmative action in the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which gave African Americans and women the legal right to fight for their rights in workplaces and to make the demand for equal pay. And so, in that sense, those claims and those struggles were legitimized. And this was especially important within public sector work, where there was a specific the entry of black workers was particularly important in that respect, where there was a specific intent to draw militant and angry African Americans into the workforce. when the Kerner Commission declared that unemployment, housing, and police brutality were the three main catalysts for the urban rebellions of the 1960s, there was an urgent attempt by the state to draw in black workers. And that meant that, you know, people did not just leave their politics at home when they, you know, came into these workplaces, but it actually helped to influence the direction of struggle in those places as well. And public sector work in general, which included teachers and social workers, attracted young workers, ex-activists, blacks, women, all of whom were undergoing intense radicalization as a result of the political struggles that were sweeping the United States. And so while strikes among public employees were illegal and were seldom known before, by the mid and late 1960s, they were regular occurrences. In 1966, there were 142 strikes by public employees. By 1968, there were 412 public employee work stoppages. Teachers were also a part of this. One historian described that in 1966 alone, teachers staged 33 workouts as compared with 26 for the entire previous decade. By the early 1970s, scores of teacher strikes annually delayed school openings. And nor were teachers the only militants, but by 1967, some 250 public employee strikes erupted, quintupling the previous one-year record. Most of these disputes were traditional labor battles with unions seeking wage increases and fairer promotions, seniority and discipline procedures, or attempting to resist the efforts of school boards and government agencies to increase workloads and intensify productivity standards. Obviously, the postal workers' strike was the highest expression of that. But I think understanding this within the larger context of the movements of the 60s is important in terms of seeing the understanding the rise of that strike activity. Between 1956 and 1965, there were never more than 4,000 strikes in a single year in the U.S. And then from 1967 to 1974, there was an average of 5,200 strikes per year. In 1956 and 1965, an annual average of over a million workers were involved in strikes. And that wave peaked in 1970, which saw 66 million strike days lost. So it's important to see this uptick in strike activity is related to the social movement of the time. Just to wrap up and end here, the strike, the upsurge in strike activity, you know, eventually ran into the buzzsaw of economic recession in 1974. That, in combination with the crushing of the social movements, which really created this sort of dynamic atmosphere within which that movement was happening, contributed to the decline of that. But there are important, you know, despite that, I think the postal worker strike in particular showed that the sort of rank and file self-activity combined with political struggle and movement could actually challenge the passivity of the trade union leadership. And I will leave it there.
That was Kihanga Yamada Taylor. And prior to her, Tara Lee, a retired postal worker, talking about the Wildcat 1970 postal worker strike. And another reminder to our listeners, the anniversary of that great strike of 1970, March 17th, is coming up this coming Sunday, and there'll be a huge rally and march to save America's Postal Service, 2 p.m., Pioneer Courthouse Square. This has been Labor Radio, Monday night, every Monday night from 6 to 6:30, of working people, by working people, for working people, the only show of its type in Oregon or Southwest Washington. Many thanks to our engineer this evening, Danielle Parks. Stay tuned for Prison Pipeline.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. to you, the all-night driver out in your cab alone. To you waiting for lunch break as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
The time is 6:32 and you are listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Aladdin Theater, presenting Alligator Records rhythm and blues artist Tommy Castro and the Painkillers, 8 p.m. Thursday, March 14th. Tickets and information for Tommy Castro and the Painkillers at the Aladdin box office and online at aladdin-theater.com. This program has also been made possible in part by Oregon Southwest Washington Carpenters Local 156, whose goal is to organize workers, provide a safe work environment, ensure livable wages, and evaluate the moral and social condition of its members. Information online at ubc156.org. And now up next is Prison Pipeline.
KBOO Community Radio Night for the 2013 Blazers season will be April 17th, the last home game of the regular season.
Tickets are limited for this unique opportunity where a portion of the proceeds will help support your community radio station.
More information can be found at kboo.fm/blazers.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.